Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shadmar Quits. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website and podcast, kereport.com or Corlin Economics Report with your podcast player. It was another kind of wild week in the markets. A lot of this volatility is driven generally by the ongoing conflict or war between Ukraine and Russia. That is causing waves in all kinds of markets, but we're not necessarily getting straight line directional plays. But overall, risk off is moving higher. And that's where we're going to start with the precious metals market, as we are chatting with Jayant Bhandari, private investor and consultant to a lot of the big investors in the resource sector. Now, Jayant, the gold price, as we're talking, which is about halfway through the day on Wednesday, gold is above 1900, had a great day Tuesday, pulling back a little bit today, but overall we did see a monthly close just above 1900 at 1970 cents on the tail end of February. That was Monday's close. Jayant, what's your takeaway from this uptrend that gold is in and the break above 1900? What do you take away from this environment?
Well, Corey, gold was doing reasonably well even before this Canadian truckers protest started and even before the war between Ukraine and Russia started. Gold was in a consolidation mode. And then two things hit. One was that Canadian Prime Minister started freezing bank accounts of some people. And not only he had the authority to freeze those accounts himself, he delegated that authority to the individual managers and branch offices of banks. Now, that brought to the front a fear that people have had about electronic money, that your bank accounts, your electronic money could get frozen at any point of time. And they are facing consequences of not having thought about this thing properly, which meant that gold visibility had to go up. And then you see the same thing with not only to do with the fear to do with the war between Ukraine and Russia, but also within Russia, Apple Pay and other electronic payment systems and bank accounts have been largely frozen, which means that now people have to be more fearful about the electronic money. And gold becomes an extremely important way to bypass electronic money and have your at least some of your wealth in your own pocket. So gold has gone up only about 5% after these two events happened, which is not a very big deal considering that inflation has been very high in the US. So I think at 1900, gold is very well supported. And even if the war between Russia and Ukraine were to come to an end immediately, gold price is not going to fall much, if at all.
Well, Jayant, you raise a good point there about some of the risk to digital money. Although we've seen some of the cryptocurrencies still move higher in anticipation that if Russia is removed from the SWIFT banking system, that maybe some citizens would access cryptocurrencies. And there's that narrative. But I see your point about there also being the value of precious metals starting to shine a bit more. And in addition, before all this Ukraine geopolitical theater started, we already had, as you mentioned, the highest inflation in 40 years. Not just in the U.S., in many countries, and also the Fed rate hiking cycle about to kick off here in March. So do you think that at this point that the Fed rate hiking cycle, and if they do move forward with it in March or sometime soon, that actually could be a negative and a drag on gold because interest rates are rising? Or do you think it may be positive because in prior rate hiking cycles, we have seen the precious metals actually excel higher?
Well, I don't think the rate hike really makes any difference now. That rate hike, expected rate hike, is already priced in the gold market, from what I think. Moreover, oil price is going up, inflation is going up, and I think stagflation is going to hit the market which means that they really don't have an opportunity to increase the rate too much. Now, if they increase rate a bit when inflation is much higher, it doesn't really make any difference anyway, because the real inflation, the real rate is still lower than what I would have expected. So I don't really give much credence to the rate hike right now, given that inflation is extremely high.
Hey, I understand what you're saying there, Giant. We have been very well warned for this rate hike. I do caution when you say that even if this war was to end tomorrow, that you don't see much or any pullback in the gold price, because you did say it did even contribute or has helped for about a 5% bump. We'll see what all happens there. And quite frankly, we don't know what will happen or even when that war will end or tensions ease. Let's move over into the stocks, though, because some of the majors, the royalty companies, the larger gold stocks, those have been running. Those have benefited from this higher gold price. The juniors still broadly have been left behind. However, this is kind of a general trend when you start to see at least bigger money coming into the sector. The retail audience still clearly more or less avoiding the sector. What do you like in these markets for gold stocks? Where do you find value out there?
Gold stocks have certainly done well over the last few weeks, and junior mining companies have lagged behind, as they usually tend to do in a situation like this. But I think that is where an opportunity is. There's a huge disconnect between the gold price and the prices of several of the junior mining companies. So I think this is an opportunity for people to invest in some of these companies.
Well, Giant, with the majors having their share prices growing in value and basically their currency, their share price going up, and with the junior prices not having moved yet, do you think that may lead to some further M&A in the sector? And I know that we were talking off mic about one deal that just happened recently, but just as a general trend, do you think we may see more M&A because of that?
Oh, absolutely. This will create a domino effect. That is exactly how the development stage companies start to move up, and then the smaller exploration and generative companies start to move up, because you keep going down the value chain. Now, we were talking about Perseus Mining making a bid for Orca. Perseus is a good company. They have done very well in the past, and I think there is a decent upside in that company itself. Now they are acquiring Orca, and with that, they will acquire Montage Gold, a company about which we have talked in the past. In my view, Montage is reasonably actually probably the cheapest gold stock I know of, despite that it has done very well since the merger between Orca and Perseus was announced. So my guess is that Perseus will go after Montage, given that they now will own about 31% of Montage. So mergers and acquisitions will pick up. Companies have to hurry up in terms of acquiring development stage projects, and that will continue, although they have been happening. Such mergers have been already happening.
So, Giant, do you like the synergies that you're seeing with that acquisition with Perseus taking out Orca? Because Orca, in all fairness, it's been around for a while. I think people were waiting for some takeout of Orca for at least the last couple of years. We finally have it, and it came at a pretty nice premium. It is a one-year high, little under where the stock peaked at just at the very start of 2021, but that was, again, after a nice run-up. So this is a takeover where most, if not, well, pretty much all shareholders are being rewarded to a certain extent, but again, the synergies that Perseus Mining is seeing here.
Oh, absolutely. This is a good acquisition. And as we have talked about this in the past, several of the African development stage companies have been forgotten by the market. And because there were either coup rumors or coups happening in West African countries, people were afraid of investing in Africa. But you really don't have, you know, you have to worry about politics, but many of these sub-Saharan African countries are what they are. And you have to understand that many of the valuations of these companies take into account the political risks in those countries. So Given that situation, I think some of these companies were cheap and they are going to get increasing visibility as time goes by because companies like Perseus and Barrick, they know, Endeavor Mining, they know how to operate in that kind of environment.
John, you're bringing up an interesting point about jurisdiction risk here with this Orca takeover by Perseus, because when you think back to it, there's been so many different takeovers of gold companies in Africa, whether it's Teranga and Semafo last year, Savory, True Gold, Griffin. We just saw Roxgold taken over by Fortuna. We've just seen a lot of transactions there, and a lot of people are hesitant to invest in a place like West Africa, even though each country is unique, and within each country, all those jurisdictions are unique. How do you approach investing in an area that's considered risky like that when you're valuing these companies?
I think investors are astute in the sense that they understand the risks associated with some of these companies, and they also appreciate the fact that they don't know much about what's happening in some of these countries. So what I look for, Shad, is that I want to have management that I trust and management that I consider to be competent. Pretty much the only thing I can do. And that's been the case with Montage. Of course, Montage has done very well. And I still think there's a lot of room for it to go to do well. But that is really the only thing I can go after, apart from the fact that I like to go to these countries by myself to experience these countries. But then for the last 2 years, I haven't really been to Africa at all.
Yeah, you're not alone, Giant. Everyone, I think, has been more or less tied up closer to home. And I think that's been used as an excuse why we've seen less M&A activity. Don't know if that's actually the case, but we have heard that's why. A lot of M&A hasn't happened during that COVID time. Any other maybe juniors or explorers that you like the work that they're doing that aren't getting the love you think they deserve? I know the list could be pretty long, but anything that's on your mind?
Yeah, so let's talk about another West African company, Nucor Gold. The ticker is NCAU, it is still trading at 54 cents. I think they have done a fabulous job, and this company will get visibility over the next few weeks, and that's where I should be investing some more of my money. We can talk about another company, Corey, if you want. That is Aztec Minerals. The ticker is AZT, and it's trading at 31 cents. They came out with a fabulous drill hole this morning, 137 meters of 1.49 grams per ton. Now, the earlier hole that they had was about 1 gram per ton. Remember, when you hit something like 1.5 grams per ton, the economics is not just 50% higher. It is a multiple higher than what it was earlier. So these kind of holes completely change the economics of the projects. And that is why I think the news release to do with Aztec is very significant, but market has not paid attention to it. And I think that is exactly when I like to invest in companies.
So, Giant, with Aztec, I know the story well. I am a shareholder, in full disclosure. They have two projects, both under JV agreements. Do you think that holds them back a little bit because of the JV aspect, even though that costs them less to drill these projects? And in all fairness, they have started to see some good results from both assets.
Yeah, I mean, JV does create some problems, life is what it is. They still own, I think, 75% of both projects. Most of the value should reflect in their market capitalization. Eventually, I think ownership should revert to 100% for each project. The market might be concerned about it, but it doesn't really matter to me at the current share price. At the current share price, Aztec, in my view, is hugely undervalued. And I can worry about what this joint venture means once the market capitalization has gone up quite a bit up from where it is today.
So, Giant, that best hole that we have that was announced this morning on Wednesday was at that Cervantes project, the other project being the Tombstone project. Which one do you like better? Do you have a preference in terms of the recent news as to which one you think could drive the stock?
Clearly the Mexican project is going to drive up the stock right now, given that this whole is fabulous, I think the market should start paying attention to what this whole means over the next few days. So this is in the driver's seat for now.
Well, Giant, I may shift it back over to Nucor Gold. And in full disclosure, I'm a shareholder of Nucor Gold and Montage Gold. And I'm a fan of West Africa and have made a lot of money investing there in the last decade because of it being more of a contrarian area. But I see Nucor very much like Montage, where they have a lot of gold already defined in the ground. They've got really solid drill programs. They're expanding their resources. I have a lot of confidence in the management teams. But why is it, do you think that, I mean, besides the jurisdiction, I always scratch my head as to why both Montage and Nucor Gold are so undervalued. If you had those kind of resources in Canada or the U.S. or even in Australia, they'd be many multiples higher. Do you think there's something else that investors are looking for? Is it because they're bulk tonnage deposits? Is it because they're not high grade? Where do you think the value disconnect is?
Well, interestingly, if you compare the share price performance of Nucor Gold and Montage Gold, they have been very correlated over the last many months. Now, of course, Montage has outperformed over the last 1 week because of this announcement of merger between Orca and Perseus. And that is what I think will eventually happen to Nucor Gold. Market stays completely disinterested in some of these companies, and then suddenly someone recognizes the value of these companies, and then they go up in one abrupt step. And that is what happened with Montage Gold. And I think there will be another step up for Montage Gold. And I think that is when Nucor will go up. There will just be one nice step up someday. When that day will come, we don't know. But when, as long as there's an upside, I would rather be invested in companies like these than wait for the so-called opportunity time to come.
Well, just one more quick follow-up on both companies and companies like this that are development stage. Both of them are working on increasing their resources. And with Nucor, they've got a resource estimate that'll be coming out in tandem with an economic study. Same thing with Montage Gold. They're getting ready to release their feasibility study. Do you think companies that are development stage that are getting ready to put out a key economic study give them the ability to get re-rated? Do you think that's a good place for investors to look for value before it's obvious to analysts?
Absolutely. I think that will be the kind of companies that will perform the best going forward, because the mining companies have done well and now it's time for the development stage companies to be seen and appreciated by the market. So I think that this is where most of the growth should happen over the next few weeks.
So Giant, to your point about Nucor and maybe some investors waking up to it, to me it sounds like they need kind of a big investor, maybe a strategic or somebody else to see the value there and, who knows, give them some more money in terms of a financing, although I know they're well cashed up, or just start buying in the market. Does that mean we need some more funds, some bigger players to come in?
Well, you don't know. As we were talking about Montage a few weeks back, you know, nothing happens and then suddenly something happens. And then when the share price goes up, it just becomes a lot easier for these companies to raise money for CapEx, for the capital. So as the share price performs, raising money becomes easier for these companies. And that can easily happen with Nucor as well. So I don't worry so much about how much money they have to raise right now, given that the upside is so nice with these some of these companies. I have to start worrying about their capabilities to raise cash when the share prices has performed quite well over the next few months or weeks. And then once they have gone up by, let's say, 50% or 100%, then I will start worrying about how they will raise cash.
So are you going to be a seller if we do get this bounce in the juniors, moving these stocks higher? I know you're not an overly active trader. You do like to buy positions and hold with companies. But would you be a seller if we do see a quick double or even 50% move in any of these juniors that have broadly lagged?
Every company that I invest in, I have a buy price and a sell price. And if my target price is reached, I will sell. I'm not in love with any of these companies. I will sell when the time comes.
Okay, Giant, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you for sharing some of your thoughts on the gold sector, but more importantly, on the stocks. If anybody wants more information on any of the stocks that we've mentioned, feel free to email us, fleck@kereport.com or chat@kereport.com. And hey, we'll get Giant back on in a few weeks to discuss more on the resource sector and also feed a little bit more on some of these stocks. Giant, thank you, as always, for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks very much, Corey and Chad.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Giant Bhandari. We did focus a lot on the precious metals sector. So in this segment, going to take a little step back, not ignore the precious metals, but talk more broadly, at least initially here, about commodities, because broadly, commodities continue to scream higher, whether it's energy, base metals, they all are continuing to break higher. We are chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago, also editor of the Lyons Share website, which we will link to in the posting for this weekend show. Now, Dana, we usually start off by talking about markets, but as I said, I want to talk commodities because as much as some of our audience is encouraged by the moves in precious metals, you look at energy, you look at base metals, man, oh man, those are screaming higher. What's your takeaway from this environment here where commodities are clearly doing well?
My takeaway is I want to be long commodities because they're going higher. And it's not, I don't think it's any recent event. I don't think it's just the Fed. I don't think it's just Ukraine. Anyone that watches the charts and watches the data has seen, you know, the signs have been indicating that you should be long commodities in general for a while now. So we've been long, whether it's, you know, energy complex, precious metals, the grains, whatever. We've been long a lot of that stuff and buying the dips for the last better part of the last year or year and a half or so, like we've talked about on your show several times over that period. And right now, I mean, there's nothing to indicate that that uptrend is over. So until proven otherwise, you know, we'll continue to ride it higher and buy the dips, you know. Eventually it'll reverse and we'll be wrong. But for right now, we'll continue to buy the dips and, like I said, ride the trend higher and don't fight the trend.
Well, Dana, I know you don't do a lot of intermarket analysis where you look at, let's say, the commodities versus the general equities, other than just more as a high level look at it. But a lot of people would have made the argument that commodities were very undervalued relative to the general equities markets, relative to real estate, relative to most other asset classes. And now they're having the re-rating that a lot of people were expecting. When you look across the basket of commodities, though, are there any that stand out to you as maybe having more upside than others? Like, is there still a ton of upside in oil and gas? Or do you think that there's certain soft commodities that may represent a better opportunity? Are there any that stick out to you?
Sure. I think the energy complex is getting a little bit long in the tooth. I mean, like I said, it's still clearly in an uptrend. No indications that I certainly wouldn't want to be shorting crude or most of the energy complex, but it's a little bit long in the tooth. The grains have really been in the near term going kind of parabolic, but they're more or less in the earlier innings of potential up move there. So in these parabolic rises, I would take some profits here and there, but in general, they might have more room to run. Like we've been talking about with the precious metals as well. You know, we had that big rally up to the 2020 peak. And since then, it's been going sideways. And as we've talked about, I think that move over the last almost 2 years now is basically a consolidation pattern, just a period of resetting the momentum, resetting the sentiment, and gearing up for the next breakout and the next big up leg in the bull market in gold and silver and the miners. So I think if you're talking about the precious metals complex, I think there is a ton of room to run higher once we do finish up with this consolidation pattern breakout. And I think it's going to have plenty of room to run higher.
Okay, so this is more of a long-term play then. Dana, what else are you watching in these markets that you think has some upside? Because again, it's been commodities. It's actually been the safe haven assets that have moved so strongly higher, like the dollar and also like bonds. What is catching your eye outside of just commodities then?
Right now, most things are, I think, are in a trading environment. So you're in this volatile period, correction period in the stock market. We made maybe a good intermediate term bottom. We had that initial low on some capitulatory type readings in January, retested that at the end of February, undercut it, and reversed higher in some of those indices, which is a textbook bottoming pattern. In addition, we saw in some of the internal measures, some of the sentiment measures, we saw a nice divergence versus that January low. One troubling thing is that we saw an expansion of new lows on the New York Stock Exchange. So it's not a perfect perfect low. I wouldn't go out and bet the farm that that the correction is over, that we continue higher. But there are signs that maybe an intermediate term low is in and we could start moving higher. But it's going to be, you're going to have even if that's the case, there's plenty of resistance here to get through after breaking down on a lot of the charts below that some of those good technical levels. So it's not going to be a straight up shot. In fact, we have, I think right now we've got a little bit of further room to go on the upside in the very near term in some of the equity indices before we get into some serious resistance. And I don't want to make any, you know, flippant war comparisons at this point, obviously, but that will be like the true battle will be at resistance levels a little bit higher. That should tell the tale of whether the bottom is in place. We should be able to break through and then start another uptrend in the intermediate term. If we fail at those levels, then we could be down testing the lows and actually putting in another leg lower, in fact. So it should be a very key test coming up shortly over the next week or so at those key levels. And we'll certainly be monitoring things very closely. But until then, you know, we've been trading a lot more than normal in these, in this type of correction environment, because you get that, like I said, you get that textbook pattern of the initial low, reflexive rebound, retest those lows, and then we're in that subsequent bounce. So we should find out, you know, pretty soon whether, you know, we're back in an intermediate term uptrend again, or maybe we get another leg lower.
Well, Dane, I know we're kind of at this tipping point where if things break up through those resistance levels, that would be bullish and people could play that momentum to the upside. But let's say you see things approach these resistance levels over the next week or two, and they get smacked down pretty hard. Would you then turn to shorting those markets, anticipating a retest of the lows or even another leg lower as you laid out? Would you get more on the short side at that point if things fail at these resistance levels?
We will we'll actually start adding some more aggressive hedges when we test those levels. We won't wait till you know, till the smoke clears. We'll add some more hedges when we test them. If we break up through there, then we'll stop ourselves out on those hedges, as the benefit of that would clearly be back to the upside. If we do, you know, pull back from those the resistance levels, we'll have some good hedges on to play that. Whether we go back down, the next test will be whether we go back down to the lows. And if we do, then the odds are we actually go lower and put a new another down leg in on the indices and the markets. And there, I should say, there are some markets that actually certainly look more vulnerable than others within this corrective period. You're talking about like Europe. A lot of the European indices look suspect. A lot of the growth areas still look suspect. The Nasdaq 100 made a nice low, but some of the areas within tech and growth still look a little bit suspect. So within that test, there might be areas that hold up better certainly than others. But we will start adding some shorts back on pretty aggressively as we test those resistance levels. And so we'll be ready if we do pull back from those levels. We'll be protected. If we break through, like I mentioned, then the odds will be certainly be better that benefit of doubt is back to the upside. And we'll be more comfortable being more aggressively long at that point.
So overall, Dan, it sounds like you're still in the strategy of hitting singles or maybe doubles here, not looking for those home run swings because of all the swings that we have seen and essentially the pullback in a wide range of markets.
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, the moves are pretty good and the pattern is so consistent in these corrections that you can make some, you don't have to put on huge trades, but they're consistent enough and you get a big enough moves that you can make a decent profit on them without betting the farm, like I said. But your point is correct. In this trading environment, in this volatile environment, there's no reason to overtrade, to put outsized positions on in this environment, especially given the headline risk. You don't want to have an uncomfortable size position on when the wrong headline hits. Even though, as we've talked about in the past, the headlines usually give you opportunity to fade. It doesn't make sense as risk managers to have too much of our clients' money exposed in this environment, in this volatile and uncertain short-term period.
Well, Dana, just one more question, and that's more on the ETFs that follow different countries. I know you track a lot of them. We've got a lot of turbulence on the global stage right now, but are there any countries that stand out to you as potentially good contrarian plays or just ones that are having better growth than people are expecting and folks aren't paying attention to it?
To be honest, when the global equities correct, everything pretty much corrects and everything is nothing in this environment is shooting up to the upside in terms of equities in this type of a correction. Obviously, there are areas that are holding up much better that when things do turn around, they'll be in position to move to new highs and start that next leg of bull market much sooner. So I would say the area of the world that we still like best, that we've liked for the last few years, that still looks perhaps prime to lead the way higher would be some of those Asian emerging markets. You know, we've been on Taiwan and Vietnam for a long time, and some of the indices aren't reflecting this yet, but you look at Indonesia, Thailand holding up right near multi-year or all-time highs, just waiting to break out. And they should have substantial room to run higher once they do break out. But I think we have to get through this near-term, this high-risk, near-term volatile period in the global equity market, perhaps before that breakout, before that run does commence.
Yeah, there's a lot of question marks, and it is a volatile environment, not just for markets, but for the world globally. But again, I think main takeaway here, at least for me over the last little bit, is just how much commodities have run. Those tie into so much other economic data, but it's also an environment where we haven't seen for a number of years commodities go on this sort of a run higher. And it's not just, I think, one reason, as you pointed out. Dana, great chatting with you as always. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. We'll chat with you in another couple weeks. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are chatting with Chris Ritchie, president of Silvercrest Metals. Silvercrest Metals is traded on the TSX under the symbol SIL and on the NYSE under the symbol SILV. Now, we're not going to be getting too much of an update here on Silvercrest, except more at the end of this interview, talking about some of the catalysts that Chris sees for the company. but I more want to talk about the general sector here. And Chris, you are at the BMO conference this week. This is a conference where a lot of the high quality companies get invited to the conference, and there are a lot of big money banks there, a lot of big money investors. I find it's a good avenue and a good time to get an understanding of what the mood is for these banks, for some of the larger investors that could be in the sector, but also sometimes are just watching the sector from the sideline. Broad question to start here, Chris, is what is the general mood at BMO, and what are some of the major themes that have caught your eye?
Yeah, thanks. A lot of really interesting things going on there. One is that costs are going up. Agnico came out and they had a pretty significant cost increases across the board, nearing in the round of 20%. The multiples of the industry are still ridiculously cheap relative to other sectors. And one of the most interesting things I read was the Glencore presentation, where the new CEO kind of got up and really highlighted this and saying all these EV companies, turbine companies, energy transition companies are trading at multiples that are just dramatically higher than where the commodity companies are, but they use all the commodities. And there's starting to be a little bit of pushback on, we aren't going to grow unless we're rewarded for that growth. Meaning a lot of these companies are trading at below replacement cost. So the cost to go find a new asset and getting up and running is higher than where the commodity prices are today. So a lot of them are just sort of saying, hey, we need to be rewarded for that growth, so we're not necessarily going to make those investments.
Well, Chris, just speaking of replacement costs in the industry, that is an interesting idea. We had talked a little bit off mic before we started recording about just what it takes mining companies, whether it's gold, silver, copper, to replace the ounces in the ground, not just on their AISC, but really from more of an expanded long-term picture. Would you mind walking people through what the reality is for mining companies and where the industry needs to get?
Sure. I can speak to silver, more closely than others, but I'm sure it's a theme that cuts across the commodity base. But you know, we did the exercise at Silvercrest to look at, you know, every single penny we've spent since day one, all the way through to the closure of the mine, including some cost inflation every year. And we're in the neighborhood of about $14 an ounce. You know, again, that's very different than our operating cost per ounce. And the reason it's a relevant number is, you know, today at $25 silver, for us, that's a lot of margin. No problem, you know, if we can replace that. But the idea of growth means, okay, well, what's the average project, right? If I'm going to go sell my ounces at $25, what am I going to do with those dollars? And do I have enough opportunities in front of me to go get back more ounces cheaper than $25 an ounce? So our all-in sustaining cost in our feasibility study was sub $7. So even if that number trickles higher, and let's just say roughly $8, the industry average, and this is as per, you know, BMO or Scotia or RBC price deck for the senior producers, is over $18. So that means that's about $10 higher for our roughly $14 replacement cost, assuming an average project. So now your hurdle rate is about $24. Well, that doesn't include your exploration. Okay. So again, who knows if you're going to spend money and not find ounces, or the project actually gets you anywhere. It's a tricky number to get, but I wouldn't think it was surprising to have a replacement cost per ounce that could be $5 to $10. So even if you want to use the lower end of that range and you use five, well, now you're getting in the high 20s. What that doesn't include is, well, it's going to take you 10 plus years to get a new project with permitting and all those other challenges in there. Well, what's the cost inflation between now and then, and what's the impact of your operating costs? So you got to price that in. What's the G&A and your overhead? What's tax risk? What's execution risk, right? So when you start to add it all up, you get a pretty clear picture for silver that the average project to go get something new up and running is higher than where silver is today. So as companies start to get cleaner balance sheets, and this is definitely the case for oil, so what we're seeing right now in the energy space is, for the first time in a long time, these companies are really healthy. They have strong free cash flow. They have strong balance sheets. And what that basically means is they have choices, you know, and when you're choking on debt and you're barely paying bills, you have to sell your commodity no matter what. You're a price taker. But now these people can show some discipline. And, you know, if logic prevails, that means people are going to be a lot more careful how they allocate capital if the growth opportunities aren't there. So again, it's going to be very interesting across all commodities to see if this means we're not going to grow until we're properly rewarded, either via the multiples or in selling your commodity at a higher price than what it costs to replace it. So we'll see. The industry hasn't been overly disciplined in the past, but again, investors have been pushing back for a long time to be disciplined. So if this is the case, there could be a big shortage coming in a market that needs even more of these commodities going forward to make this green energy transition that everyone's pushing for.
So, Chris, big picture, are you saying here that the mining companies could, in a way, almost band together here and say, we're not going to keep producing these metals simply because you guys aren't buying our shares? You're not giving us the value for it, and everything's getting more expensive. So, quite frankly, we're going to take control of the narrative. We being the mining companies, and in a way, completely disrupt supply.
Well, right now, you know, the world has a time span that is about as long as a tweet, and it takes about 20 years to bring a new mine online. So if you're sitting on big growth projects and you've got the expertise and the balance sheets while still having big, robust production profiles, the best thing you can do is just to produce and you know, do the right things by your money. Maybe that means buying back your stock with your capital as opposed to building projects, you know, increasing your dividends. So it's not about collusion or anything like that. It's just more saying we now have the flexibility to behave appropriately. And until you're rewarded for growth, doesn't make sense to grow. And again, this is really where the big picture long-term stuff really makes sense. Because again, North America, we're very short-term focused, you know, but yet we're dealing in a world right now with countries like China and whatnot that are dealing very long-term focused. And I think that sort of speaks to some of the geopolitical challenges we're having here, where commodities themselves are turning into currencies. And obviously we're seeing massive inflation with COVID and whatnot. So the world revolves around these commodity prices.
Well, Chris, on that point about commodities being the new currencies, even some of the sanctions that have been put on Russia have only helped the currencies that they export, whether it be oil and natural gas or palladium and nickel or the wheat and the grains and the soft commodities. And if they're removed from the SWIFT banking system and kind of isolated, they could easily start teaming up with China. That's another commodity powerhouse. And it could be that the East has a stranglehold on commodities even more so than they do now if Western companies are not compensated. So how do you think that all flushes out?
I think in the early days of this invasion into Ukraine, you know, you hear some people saying, oh, the West should go in and fight back. I think we need to be careful to understand if we go in and Russia is on its knees and Putin's on his last days, he still has access to nuclear weapons. So I think you have to look at the end game to realize that in today's day and age, any war can end really badly with superpowers. So the types of wars we're going to be fighting are hopefully anything but wars, you know, with military forces. And if that's the case, these commodities become the currency. And it's no surprise that, you know, prior to this invasion, that Russia had enough gold that equaled 80% of the rubles. Well, the ruble just got crushed and gold just went way up. So they had been years for years and years and years getting this hedge, right? 39 or 40% of their GDP is oil. Yes, that's cut off, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's other countries around the world buying their oil. You know, the nat gas leverage they have over Europe. So these commodities are becoming currencies. And, you know, with these sanctions and whatnot, it's just driving up prices left, right, and center. And one of the crazy things was right before Thanksgiving this year, the US government actually released strategic petroleum reserves to try to drop oil prices before driving season and Thanksgiving. You know, and if that's the sort of way the West is thinking in terms of extremely short-term gratification and political expediency relative to countries looking up to tie up resources for strategic reasons, these commodities are becoming more and more important. It only reinforces that concept of the replacement cost and the true value of these resources. Again, all while these companies are trading at extreme lows right now while being really healthy. So if these CEOs are starting to realize, hey, we've got a lot of leverage with these big resources and we're not rewarded appropriately for growing right now, there's a really big dynamic here that just speaks to, you know, the valuation and the value in the space.
So then, Chris, who do you see coming in as buyers? Because you have laid out, I think, a very logical, I guess, balance of what we are seeing within the sector here and the mostly unloved nature that investors have taken towards mining companies. Are the big banks interested in either starting to buy up some sort of commodities themselves or actually putting their money behind mining companies, saying that, look, we do need these assets? And quite frankly, resource prices have gone up. So companies are stronger balance sheet wise, really across the board, especially cash flow wise.
Yeah, I think there's a few different players out there. I mean, if you're big governments around the world looking to buy up big strategic deposits of things that are nowhere near coming to cash flow and just sitting on them, I mean, I think some of these strategic buyers, you know, you might be producing some of these commodities, but they might never hit the market. They might just go into warehouses for these countries behind these things. So like supply and demand challenges. And the reality in the market, you know, mining is a tiny, tiny percentage. I think it's less than 1 or 2% in the broad U.S. indices. So the general market just doesn't care. And that's just the nature of where things are. So there's no new money. There's no new fund flow. You know, if you look at some of the momentum and quant fund behavior, we had a call with a brokerage fund last week that said, like, yeah, sure, short-term momentum is starting to pick up for the gold and silver space. It's kind of middle of the pack. But long-term momentum is still near the basement levels. So we really haven't seen the long-term momentum pick up to sort of wake up some of that institutional money or quant funds and retail. Like, they're nowhere near this space. I mean, we're still at lower silver levels we were than Wall Street silver sort of rush a year ago. And basically, no retail. I mean, this came off one of the worst years in a long time for the gold and silver space, when it was the second worst performing sector in the Canadian market. A huge tax loss selling, and this is just low volume, you know, gapping up on some of the macro and geopolitical stuff. So I don't think we've seen real buying yet, which kind of bodes well, because as everyone knows, for cyclical businesses, these higher commodity prices are actually making the stocks cheaper. Right. So they're going up and the valuations aren't, right? You know, you go up a little bit, but again, the price increases are making these things stay extremely cheap.
Well, Chris, just along those lines, with these inflationary pressures hitting a lot of companies, but also with metals prices staying buoyed and actually heading higher, which does help with the margin expansion, how is SilverCrest set up, and what are the main takeaways you want people to know from the SilverCrest balance sheet, from the growth profile, and really the direction moving forward for 2022?
Yeah, we've always been really big on promoting our defense and our balance sheet and our margins and the quality of the asset, because if you get crazy volatility, you know, you want to show resilience across the ups and the downs. We've always referred to, you know, $19 silver and $1,500 gold giving us $160 million of project level free cash flow in 2023. But if you look at our feasibility study numbers at $1,950 gold and $27 and change silver, that project level free cash flow, and that's an after-tax number, but it's again before G&A and exploration and whatnot, that number is over $200 million for next year. So, you know, if you look at the market cap today and you look at sort of the free cash flow profile, you're getting something, you know, in and around sort of the 9 to 12, 13% free cash flow yield in your year one, you know. So this is something where, again, the cash balances are going to grow really quickly with these companies. Quickly. So again, from a risk perspective, we're very happy that we're nearing the end of construction, which is usually no man's land. You know, we're going to have, you know, somewhere between, you know, 40 and 60 million of additional capital after the construction's over. And the amount of debt we have is about 90 million. So that free cash flow number, it's not only is the excess cash mostly going to pay that down, you know, the free cash flow alone would be paying that off in 2 or 3 quarters. So our timing is fantastic in terms of coming to the end of construction. We should be sort of ramping up the plant and whatnot in Q2 this year, right? So I think the timing is quite interesting. Again, after us being sort of in the depths of no man's land with everybody being so afraid of these cost increases. So again, for people that are getting out of the way and whatnot, we're hopefully going to hit the mark, our cash flow, right at the right time.
So, Chris, let's talk a little bit more about the SilverCrest share price and some of the potential buyers that could come into the stock, because I think we all agree that there isn't a whole lot of new money coming into the sector, or any new money, even with some of these better financial metrics, everything, the better fundamentals that we're seeing within these companies, the Silvercrest share price has bounced nicely from a low in October on the Toronto Exchange of a little over $8. Now the share price right around $12. So it has benefited, but that's still off of the highs of over $16 at the beginning of 2021. As the company moves forward closer to production, who are some of the new buyers that could come into the stock and provide that catalyst to keep moving the stock higher?
Sure. Well, one, retail hasn't been there. They were beat up pretty badly last year. So I think that's someone that's a sector that's just really ripe for a lot of new buying. Our short interest actually went up near the end of last year. And we talked about that in the last call. So, I mean, there's probably a fairly significant short cover that is potentially out there. And the last update I got that the short interest was not even down at all, even despite this recent move. You know, once you get into production, if you're over 750 million US market cap and you trade more than $1 million a day in liquidity, and we're averaging about 20, you become eligible for the GDX. And that's a big ETF, and that ETF has to go out and buy a bunch of shares. I don't have the math, and we're potentially eligible in the back half of this year, but it's not a slam dunk. But there's potential pretty significant buying that would occur from that. And there's also a lot of big funds that are in the mining space that don't like companies that aren't producing. So at the end of the day, you can sort of say that these big funds can say, hey, we're in the mining space, but, you know, we can't touch you until you kind of get through that construction phase. So, you know, there's a lot of people that could look at this. And not to even mention, if you go back to Q4 2020, Q1 2021, a little bit of Q2 2021, we traded approximately $2.9 billion above the $9 US share price level. And the reason I referenced those particular three quarters is that was prior to our feasibility study coming out, prior to our financing. It was right at the front of construction, right when everybody is, hey, get me out of here, I don't like the risk profile, you know, but that's in and around today's share price. So if you can look at it now, gold price is up, we're right near the end of construction, our balance sheet is strong. You can almost get back in at the same price as people sold with a completely different risk reward dynamic. So even if you have a small percentage of that 2.9 billion of stock traded above those levels come back, that would tighten up the supply and demand of the stock itself. I know the people that love this space tend to look at some of the small stuff, but if you really think of a global, on a global perspective, we're a tiny company. So again, you know, 100, 200, 300 million of demand coming from the shareholders that appreciated the early run-up, got out before the big risk. You know, again, if they just come back a little bit, it can have a really big impact.
Well, Chris, we're going to wrap it up here. And you bring up some very good points and some good, I guess, strategy in a way of how the mining sector could start to take control of their own narrative. I really haven't heard this argument before, but it does make sense as these companies are better positioned from a cash perspective and from a balance sheet perspective, which is much, much different than what we saw last time. Gold, or, well, gold especially was at these levels, and silver still broadly lagging gold. But overall, thank you for the update. Thank you for the insights into the BMO conference. If anybody has any follow-up questions on the silver market or even Silvercrest, as always, you can email us, fleck@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. Full disclosure, Chad is a shareholder of Silvercrest Metals. And hey, everybody, Chris included, thank you for taking time with us on this weekend show. We'll be back full time next week covering these wild markets and hopefully some more positive moves in some of these metals and commodities and the underlying stocks. Everyone, thank you for tuning in this weekend, and I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.